Well, hey there, you vinyl maniacs. This week's show is brought to you in part by our friends at AudiophileUSA.com. Check out the new website at AudiophileUSA.com. Now it's even easier to dig and find the deals and use discount code THEVINYLGUIDE to save an extra 10%. That's AudiophileUSA.com. And we're also brought to you today by the Groove Washer, the world's most beloved record cleaner. Recently awarded 5 out of 5 stars from Rolling Stone magazine for vinyl record care. Plus, check out the new Groove Guard record sleeves, now at a low introductory price at GrooveWasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10. Thank you, sponsors. And with that, on with the show. Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 318 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors, music nerds, and, of course, vinyl maniacs. My name is Nate. I've made this podcast now over 6 years and 300-something episodes, talking to my heroes about music and the records that I love and collect. And today we've got a very special episode. Not only did I talk to one of my heroes, the man actually came over to my house. Mr. Dave Tice of Buffalo, the Count Bishops, and many other projects. He drove across town to sit on my couch, drink my coffee, and share his stories. And wow, what stories they are. So many that we're going to split the conversation over 2 episodes. Over the course of episodes 318 and 319, Dave's going to tell tales from the early days. The pre-Buffalo band Head, making the move in the early 70s from Brisbane to the big smoke of Sydney, playing the pubs, becoming the first Australian band signed to the Vertigo label, recording those amazing albums, opening for Black Sabbath, Rainbow, and others, near punch-ups with Ritchie Blackmore, joining the Count Bishops, what's up with the vinyl repressings, and lots, lots, lots more. Plus, we touch on the upcoming LP from Buffalo Revisited, Volcanic Rock Live. Dave and some heavy-hitting musicians performing the album Volcanic Rock in full. It's on Ripple Music, available on limited vinyl splatter pressings. You can go to ripple-music.com, reserve your copy of Buffalo Revisited, and grab some of their other records. Ripple Music is a killer label with lots of interesting stuff there. Oh, and while you're on the interwebs, take a moment to sign up to our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. It's the perfect Christmas gift for me. Help support our show, get access to all the extras, including this full interview with Dave, which has been available since last week, only to our Patreon supporters. I always put extra stuff up there, extended interviews, secret episodes, and more. Sign up now at patreon.com/vinylguide, where you get to hear the rest of the show. And with the upfronts done, let's get into the first of our 2-part conversation with dead set Aussie legend, Mr. Dave Tice. We are here with the legend Dave Tice, and thank you so much for coming over. This is our first in-person interview in over a year.
Wow.
So thanks for making the drive over here.
Well, am I a post-COVID interview?
You are. And, I'll let everyone know, we don't have masks on. We shook hands.
That's right.
All cordial. He's using our coffee cups. Everything is as normal here.
Well, it looks like a pretty hygienic situation you have here, Nate, so I'm not particularly concerned.
Yeah, I know. I'm always having to prove myself. So now, as most people know, Dave is an absolute legend. Many, many bands, and I'm really keen to dive in and really explore your career because it has so
many. You'll need a guide.
Pardon?
You'll need a guide.
I need a few Sherpas, I think, here. Now, the one thing in doing the research for this interview, there's one quote that stuck out to me here, and I think it's beautiful. And let me know if this is out of context or anything, but your quote of that you never craved acceptance from a straight society.
Well, yes, I suppose that's a rather sweeping sort of comment. You know, mm-hmm. I was, it's not so much straight society, but what generally seems to be the thing that is accepted most by what I call straight society is pop music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can enjoy pop music, but it really doesn't do much for me, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. So really what I was saying was that I was not really particularly interested in that sort of pop commercial success. quite frankly, I find the whole celebrity kind of thing a bit creepy, you know. And, you know, seems to me like the more famous you get, the greater the opportunities for disaster, you know. You know, it's a dangerous place to be. You only have to look at some of the greatest, most well-known artists in the world and see what it's done to them, you know, because, you know, you can reach a certain stage where, and I've been close to this a couple of times, where you have, you know, you've got your road crew, you've got your tons and tons of equipment, you've got an agent, a manager, a publicist. I've had all of these things going on in the past. And you become a cash cow, basically, to support this whole industry, which has really nothing to do with what your job is, which is being an artist, a musician, an artist. All of these things take away from that, I think. You know, look at people like Elvis Presley, you know, Michael Jackson. They've all been screwed by the corporation that's been built around them each time. What I like to do, and this may seem like a pretty obvious thing to say, I like to play music. I don't care about that other stuff. You know, money, you know, I've got enough to live on. I don't need to have $1 million in my bank account. It'd be nice if I did, but I don't need it. You know, and it's always been my opinion that, that it's like possessions, you know. You think you own things, but in fact, you are responsible for them. They kind of own you, you know. If you own a car, you have to keep servicing it. You've got to keep paying the registration. You've got to have all this stuff going on. You own a home, you've got rates, you've got bills, blah, 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 blah. And it ties you to one thing all the time. You know, I just don't like that at all. You know, I like to be – I've always done what I wanted to do. That's a bit selfish in many ways, I suppose. But that's the truth of it. I've done what I wanted to do, and I haven't done the things I don't want to do. The one thing that helped me to formulate this particular philosophy was what happened with Buffalo. You know, we had a recording contract, and we actually made 5 albums. But the last 2 albums we made were with different lineups. You know, members of the band were sacked from the original band and replaced with other people, all because our management and our record company wanted us to put out a hit single. And they couldn't see that happening with what we were doing in their first 3 albums, which is what Buffalo was about, you know. So they forced us to change. You know, we had very little control of that because we were contracted. We had to deliver an album a year, you know, and suddenly, you know, from, hey, we're doing what we want to do, aren't we? Making great music and don't care if the radio station's playing it, you know, because people will come into our gigs. But, you know, then you've got, you know, as I say,
a dozen people on the payroll then that you have to look after and those sort of concerns.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, we had an 8-ton truck. We had 3 road crew. We had it full of PA gear and all the rest of it. And that's because we were a live gigging, touring band, you know. So we had to have those things. But still, you know, the situation generally worked out that the first people to be paid were the agents. The second ones were our management. The third ones to be paid were the road crew. And then came the bills for the truck and all the rest of it. And the players who were getting up on stage night after night after night, and sweating them away and doing as good as they could do, they were the last ones on the payroll, you know, and there would be months go by where all I would personally be making was enough to buy a couple of meals a day. Now, when you look at a situation like that, you start to say, you know, why am I doing this? You know, it stops being fun. And if it's not enjoyable, I really don't see the point in doing it, frankly. You know, I've always loved it. I like being on stage. I like playing music. And it's always been a journey as far as I'm concerned. I started out with no musical ability. Started messing around with friends, you know, just trying to emulate the people that we admired musically. Initially, I was going to be a guitar player. My parents scraped together enough money to buy me a guitar. This at that particular point, I, along with a number of other kids and other families, were living with our parents on Wakel Migrant Hostel. We were all migrants to Australia, and we were initially housed in this hostel. So I met kids of my own age, which I, in England, I didn't really have that many friends my own age because we lived on a farm. And suddenly I started to appreciate music because of their record collections. And so we thought, well, we'll try this ourselves, you know. Con Dad into buying, you know, $20 guitar.
Do you remember the records that inspired you to want to go in that direction?
Yes. I mean, look, just before we migrated from England over to this country, I visited a friend, a school friend, at his family home, which was some miles from where we used to live on a farm. We never had electricity at the time, no TVs, things like that, but they had electricity and a black and white television. And I just happened to be there visiting him, and there was a TV show on, and the Rolling Stones were performing on this show. Now, I'd heard all the Beatles and the Tommy Steeles and your Cliff Richards, and I thought, God, this is pretty twee, you know. But when I saw the Stones, something clicked in me, you know. I liked the fact that what they were doing was raw, it was honest, and they weren't attempting to appeal to 15-year-old girls, okay?
But they did.
Well, of course they did, yeah, yeah. Well, look, you know, one of the first live shows I ever saw was a concert by the Rolling Stones in Brisbane at a place called Festival Hall in Brisbane. I would have been about 15 at the time, I suppose. And I bought my ticket and went along to this show. And the Stones came on, and I didn't hear a note that they played, because the place was just full of screaming girls. The front of the stage, you couldn't see the band because it was all these large black T-shirt guys standing there throwing screaming girls back into the crowd. You know?
So, and you thought to yourself, that's what I want to do. Well,
that's exactly what I thought. I thought, man, you know, look at this. These chicks are throwing themselves at these blokes. You know, they're having to beat them off. I've got to get myself a gig like this.
I can really see, actually, you mentioned that, I could really see a lineage from the bad boy image that Buffalo had directly to the Rolling Stones.
Well, I think, you know, it's part of a sort of it's part of rock and roll, you know, real rock.
But
real
rock. Buffalo was a little bit more dangerous than the rest of the bands.
Yeah,
fair to say.
I would think so. Yeah, you know, but you know, in a lot of ways, these are perceptions that other people have of you. We didn't attempt with Buffalo to. I mean, for a start, look, Buffalo evolved from a blues band. Pete Wellesenhire, who you may know, people from Rose Tattoo, a slide player. Well, Pete was a bass player, and we met in about 1967 in Brisbane. And, you know, in fact, I learned a lot from Pete. He was a much more – he'd been around a bit more than myself and the other guys. And so we spent many, many hours putting things together and trying to learn East West. Do you know East West?
Paul Butterfield?
Paul Butterfield Blues Band, yeah. And because we, you know, from the Stones and the guys that I met on the hostel prior to this, I had started to realize that what the Stones were doing was so much based on American blues music. And we kind of researched that a bit. You know, we say, well, where did this come from? Where did that come from? Oh, wow, well, Muddy Waters. We'll have to check that out. So that's what we would do, you know. We would get the records by these kind of guys, which were hard to get in Australia at the time, and Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and that's the sort of stuff that Pete and I were intent on doing. So we put together a blues band called Head up in Brisbane after we'd both worked with a number of other bands prior to that, of course, and got back together again. And we determined that the only way we were going to, because Brisbane, being a blues band in Brisbane was basically, you know, as good as committing suicide.
Been on the moon.
but you know, we thought, well, we can't stay here and try and do this. So we brought ourselves and the other two guys, what we had in the band, down to Sydney. We immediately hit a problem anyway, because Head was not going to be accepted by any of the local agents. So oh man, the connotations are drugs, sex, or can't you know, it won't be accepted. So We eventually managed to find an agent who was prepared to take us on, but he insisted that we should change the name to something beginning with B.
The letter B.
Yes.
Anything as long as it began with B.
Beginning with B, yeah. Because, and we said, well, why? You know, and he said, well, you know, just think, bands beginning with B, they're very successful. You know, the Beach Boys, the Beatles. And that was hard. That was very hard to argue with. You know?
Sound logic.
So what we did, in fact, was we left the meeting and we got a map of Australia because we wanted to keep some sort of Australianness about what we were doing, you know. Put a blindfold on and we got a pin and stuck it in a map. And the map also listed certain flora and fauna around the country. And the nearest name beginning with B was Buffalo. Mm. So we said, that'll do. And it also kind of coincided with us getting John Baxter in as a guitar player because our original two guys from Brisbane, drummer and guitar player, had lost the faith and gone home to their girlfriends. So the sort of music we were starting to do, because John was not a blues player. You know, the first thing I still remember, the first time we auditioned John, it was in a basement, somebody's house in Darlinghurst. And so we had a bit of a jam, turned up there and started jamming. And we'd been banging away for a while. And so Pete said, oh, I'm just going outside for a cigarette. And I said, oh, I'll come with you, mate. So we went outside. Pete said to me, Pete, you can't play blues, man. This guy's not a blues player. And he said, yeah. He said, I know, but what he's doing is kind of interesting. We should give it a go. So we did, you know, and of course John was a riff merchant, you know, he's always coming up with riffs and so we started getting work with the name Buffalo because we now began with B.
Right. Lo and behold.
So we started doing a few things around the place. But
before we go on the Buffalo adventure, while the band was Head, there was a single.
Yes.
Hobo and Sad Song?
Sad Song, in brackets, Then.
Then. Okay. Tell me the story about that.
Well, you know, after we got John in the band, we'd started jamming a bit more, and we started to feel that what we were doing was pretty good. You know, when you're young and full of yourself, it's easy to believe that what you're doing is very good. So, anyway, I think we were coming along quite nicely, and we thought, well, if we're going to go any further from this, we need to get a record contract. So, because we believe so much in ourselves, we immediately said, right, off we go down to the office of Phonogram. Now, I don't know if you remember Phonogram. They were a division of Philips.
Okay.
One of the first parts of Philips way back when. So we arrived at their offices, trooped in, said to the receptionist, we want to see your A&R manager, please.
Right. This is right downtown Sydney.
It's just in Darlinghurst, in Pelican Street, in Darlinghurst it was. I think Rhinoceros Studios now is in the building that used to be Phonogram. Anyway, so we walked in there, and, you know, by all rights, we should have been shown the door, you know. But for some reason, the receptionist said, oh, hang on, I'll just see if he's in. There's some guys out here, they reckon, you know. And amazingly enough, he said, well, send them in, I'll have a chat with them. And we spent about, you know, half an hour telling him how much he really needed us, which he took with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, he said, look, I said, what about this? He said, I'm not going to offer you a contract at this point, but I'm prepared to put you into a studio and you put down two songs so we can put out a single and see how that goes. Can you imagine that happening now?
Okay. I'm barely imagining it happening then. I mean, you guys, I mean, at the end of that meeting, you knew at the end of that meeting that you were going to do a single, right?
Yes.
So obviously in your young head, oh, that's the way it happens.
That's
right. It totally worked that way.
We couldn't see any reason why it wouldn't happen that way, you know. You know, when you have that much self-belief, you don't see the obstacles. You only see the opportunities, you know.
God bless you. Yeah.
Anyway, so He put us into this four-track studio in North Sydney, which would, you know, be lucky to call itself a rehearsal room nowadays. Mm-hmm. But so we banged out those two songs, you know, and they put it out as a single. And surprisingly enough, considering, I mean, we were pretty much an unknown quantity at that point, it sold enough that basically, you know, after that, you know, we called into the offices again, and they said, look, we'd like to offer you a contract. And so initially a three-year contract with an album a year and a couple of singles, with the possibility of an extension at the end of the three-year period. And that's what happened. We did, you know.
That's how you got the contract with Vertigo.
Yeah, well, it was with Phonogram initially.
Okay.
But what happened was that, you know, around about the same time, Black Sabbath, for instance, were starting to make some waves, and they were on Vertigo. And Vertigo was just one more of the labels that was owned by Philips.
Okay.
Our company, record company here, obviously would send anything that came out from Australia over to the head offices where they would, you know, say, well, this is not a piece of Australian rubbish, and they throw it in the bin. Right. Okay. But it just so happened that it, you know, what we were doing suited the Vertigo label, and we were offered the opportunity to, you know, go onto that label. Because of the associations, I mean, I must admit that, you know, one of the things that Dermot Hoy, who was the A&R guy at Phonogram at the time, one of the things that he was aware of was the growing popularity of Black Sabbath. And he saw us as like the Australian answer to Black Sabbath.
Right.
Frankly, apart from the fact that we were loud and obnoxious, I don't really see how we were. But, you know, we were certainly a heavy band. And at that time, we were about the only band in Australia that could have been called that.
Right.
You know.
The Vertigo Swirl label is so revered these days.
Yes.
Was it back then? What was the perception?
Well, it was set up that way, I think. I mean, the whole point of it was there was going to be a very specific type of music. And, you know, the sort of people that like that sort of music tend to be very loyal. You know, they defend their choices. They believe in it. You know, Vertigo was set up to basically take advantage of that, I think, in many ways. Somebody smart had decided, look, you know, we need to look at this part of the market. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of good bands on the Vertigo label. And at the time, we were the only non-English band on that label.
Was there ever discussion about Buffalo being released in the UK?
Not that I can recall. The interesting thing is that I found out in recent years that we were actually released in France, which is a strange kind of thing. You know, one of the things about the Australian industry, especially in those days, was this inferiority complex. You know, there was a perception that Australian bands had no chance in America or Europe. Okay. In some ways, I can understand that because it's a bit like taking coals to Newcastle, you know, or selling refrigerators to the Eskimos, you know. But, you know, I mean, it's still there to a certain degree, you know. There's this reluctance from the business side of it over here to put a lot of work into trying to break an Australian act overseas. It's interesting that it should be so when, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world is called AC/DC, even though it's made up of mainly Scottish guys, still they're an Australian band. Right. They were conceived and grew here. In excess, and there's been a number of others as well that have been very successful overseas. I mean, what surprises me was that the Easy Beats, in my opinion, should have broken overseas.
Right.
You know, made fantastic music for that period of time. I mean, just fantastic, and, you know, equal to anything from overseas.
The playbook in those days for Australian bands seems to be they get a local following, they build popularity here, and then they piss off to the UK.
Yes, where they're ignored.
Well, sometimes they're ignored, but that was kind of their shot. That was the moonshot at that point. Did Buffalo have a conversation about possibly doing that?
Well, obviously, we always like the idea of trying to do it. You know, the interesting thing is that Volcanic Rock, which was the second album we did, and was probably the heaviest album we did as well in many ways, was actually getting airplay in New York, Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
Obviously, because a DJ there had heard something, saw the name and thought, well, who are named after us or something, you know?
Yeah.
Now, without a release over there, that should happen was quite amazing. And, you know, when we heard that was going on, we actually went to our record company and said, look, we're getting airplay in America. Mm-hmm. Surely we should be looking for a way to try and exploit this, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe release this stuff over there and we'll go over there and do some gigs, you know. They laughed at us. They thought it was ludicrous. You know, like, come on, guys, you're a straight band. You ain't got a chance, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, you see, that's the problem, you know. We live a long way from the center of it all. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's good because we can develop what we do without all those overbearing influences.
Right.
That you know, and in a lot of ways, you know, that the Australian record industry in the early 70s was very much in its infancy. Mm-hmm. Their main source of income was issuing Australian copies of overseas hits.
Right.
Okay. In fact, they were just, you know, it's like Woolworths, they got shops in every major city, and then they got those little ones scattered out in the bush. Okay. Right. That's where we were.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Comparatively speaking.
They weren't prepared to make the investment.
No. In fact, I'm sure that for a very long time, the money that they spent recording, releasing, promoting Australian stuff was a tax write-off.
Mm.
Right? They would get, you know, the tapes from America, the latest hits over there, get them pressed here, bang them out, sell them by the truckload.
Right.
They had to write it off somehow, you know.
Oh, okay.
So what they would do is they would be their tax write-off, you know. Oh, we had, you know, put this much money into this band, failed badly, sorry. But don't have to pay the tax now.
Well, interesting you say that, because I suppose looking at it in that direction, they needed to have the local scene, you know, live acts, local bands, everything, to continue to get more listeners
yes.
to the label, even just to be interested in music, to get them into the record shop so they could sell them a myriad of different things.
Yes, yes.
They needed the local bands to be able to continue this ecosystem.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, most of the earlier Australian releases mm-hmm. were, in fact, straight copies of records that came from America or England.
Mm.
You know, the only band that I can think of that was really creating unique music in Australia back in the late 60s and early 70s was Easy Beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the other bands, you know, Flake, I can remember for Flake, Autumn,
mm-hmm.
you can run them off, you know. Their hits were things like Automata hit with Green River, mm-hmm. which had been a huge hit in America.
Right.
You know, so they'd make a version.
Localized version.
A local version, you know. And that was going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was just, as I say, this perception that, sorry, you're Australian, you just ain't going to be as good. Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
Now, do you know what's happened to the master tapes?
Buffalo master tapes?
Yeah.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, have you checked out audiophileusa.com lately? There's been a major new website redesign, and now it's even easier to search and dig for deals. audiophileusa.com has over 42,000 used vinyl titles in stock, all excellent and near mint condition. They sell nothing but the best condition records. And audiophileusa.com is not just for rare and collectible records. It's got something for everyone. All genres, from punk to pop to jazz to classical to metal to psych and more. Head over to audiophileusa.com, dig for the deals, fill up your cart, and use discount code THEVINYLGUIDE to save 10% off your purchase. There's something for everyone at audiophileusa.com. I know that you know that Groove Washer makes the world's best record cleaner. Hundreds of people around the world have tried it and given Groove Washer top ratings online, including Rolling Stone magazine, 5 out of 5 stars for Vinyl Record Care. But have you seen the new Groovewasher Grooveguard record sleeves? Now you can slide your freshly cleaned record into an archival quality sleeve for short or long-term storage. I mean, why are you going to clean your records only to slide them back into the same old dirty sleeve? That's like showering and putting your dirty clothes back on. Head over to groovewasher.com, grab a record cleaning kit and some Grooveguard record sleeves, now at a super low introductory price, and it gets even lower with discount code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. That's Groovewasher Grooveguard record sleeves, groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Now, do you know what's happened to the master tapes?
Buffalo master tapes?
Yeah.
Well, I'd assume, although I could be wrong, that they would be archived in Universal's archives now.
Not the one that burned up a few years ago.
I can't really tell you. I don't know. But okay. The fact of the matter is that I'd be surprised if those tapes survive at all.
Right.
Because, you know, our first album recordings was done in something like a 12-track studio.
Right.
And then, of course, it became 24-track as our career progressed. But back in those days, you'd make an album using, let's say, 2-inch tape, 24-track, 2-inch tape.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be mixed, mastered, cut onto vinyl. These tapes would be stored for a while, and then they'd be reused. This is similar to what the ABC, for instance, you know, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. You know, I've been able to collect up a few things that we did in the early days that were filmed by the ABC. GTK was one of the shows, you know, things like that. Now, they've been given to me by people who had access to the ABC archives, and they've made copies and snuck them out, okay, which is lovely, you know, great that people do that, you know, but I know that there's a lot of stuff there that should be there that the tapes have been reused, simple as that. This has been sitting around for 4 months now, nobody would be interested in this in 3 years' time.
Yeah, back then they didn't really think long-term like that.
Yeah. Well, we didn't think long-term like that, you know. I mean, here I am speaking to you now, being interviewed about that part of my career. I'm sure you'll ask questions about the rest of it.
Sure.
But, you know, the Buffalo thing has a life way beyond we ever expected it to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea, you put out an album, you might have a year to 18 months, sales would drop off drastically, and it would be, you know, stored in the back of their warehouse from then on, sent off to the recycling bin if it did. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The fact, you know, look, Nate. I mean, I've just recently done a reply to an email interview from America, right, where they're really starting to find all this Australian music that they never knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going, wow, how come we never knew about this before? You know, and Buffalo is like that. You know, it's almost 50 years since we were making records.
Mm-hmm.
And people just, the interest just doesn't wane. It just doesn't die. In fact, if anything, it grows at the moment. And I'm sitting around going, what the hell is going on, man? You know, I think, a lot of the modern music these days just doesn't have the same heart, you know. It's too much of it is machine made. This ridiculous search for perfection, you know, and music is not about perfection. It's about inspiration,
right.
You know. It's about passion and inspiration, and I just don't hear a lot of passion in the music anymore. It's so banal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You get all these guys that, you know, you hear this band, they're a hard rock band, man. Oh, they're the meanest hard rock band. And I listen to them, I go, well, Jesus Christ, I can't hear any passion in this. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that, you know, I talk about blues, right, and the influence it had on my career. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that struck me most about it when I first began to hear it, was how much passion there was in it and truth, honesty. There's no guile. There's no bullshit in there. This is true. And you can hear the humanity in it. And I don't hear that humanity the same way I used to anymore. And I think that people miss that, you know. People who like, you know, something a bit more than machine-made noises, mm-hmm. they want to hear the sweat, you know.
They want to hear the mistakes. They want to be able to hear some of those. There's that note at the end of Led Zeppelin Rock and Roll. You know what I'm talking about? That Jimmy Page.
Well, see, this is human. This is human. Absolutely. You know, machines don't make those sort of mistakes, right? You know, one of Pete Wells' things, especially later in his career, when he was making solo albums, he would go into a studio with players that he knew and had some history with. And he'd have a whole bunch of songs written, and he would allow no rehearsal time. Mm-hmm. Okay, he would say, "Okay, it goes like this. This is the feel. There's a 12 bar or whatever. Mm-hmm. Away we go." And he wasn't interested in whether anybody made mistakes or not. You know, all he wanted was to hear some heart in it.
Right.
And his one of his sayings was, you know, listen, if you make a mistake, do it again, because then it becomes the arrangement. You know, and you know, one of the things about rock and roll and blues was that there were no hard and fast rules. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, it was open slather. You could do things that, you know, classical musicians would go, "Oh my God, that's not music. What are you doing there?" You know, mm-hmm. or a jazz player would, "Oh my God," you know. But you know, it's true. This is truth. This is mm-hmm. human beings expressing themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not people making products using machines.
Right.
It's people expressing themselves. And, you know, you just showed me a little video of people dancing and having a great time, mm-hmm. right? Because obviously the relief of being able to do it now after a year and a half or something and not being able to do that. And, you know, this is human. Sometimes you must lose yourself a little. Mm-hmm. You must let yourself go. You can't be uptight and controlled every minute.
Yeah.
It's wrong, wrong, wrong. We need that release. I need it. Mm-hmm. I get it because when I play music, I lose myself in that moment. I don't care anymore that I owe a $500 electricity bill, you know, mm-hmm. or the mortgage is a bit behind this month. All I'm interested in at that point is the music. That's all. I can lose myself there.
There's also this point, I would imagine, of vulnerability, a bit of walking a tightrope. Like a lot sure. of these, you know, some of my favorite records that I have, most popular records out there, are ones that were recorded within a few days. And absolutely. they weren't given the opportunity to overthink. They didn't have the technology to fix every little nuance that
yep.
the artist may at the time have wanted to change.
Yep.
But there's that tension of being able to get it right. Like you say, Pete Wells, they'd do the arrangement, they'd show it to him, and then within a few minutes, they'd be recording it. So that's everyone right. was on their highest attention
that's right.
to drive it in.
You have to let yourself go in these situations, mm-hmm. you see. You know, I mean, look, I started out wanting to be a guitar player. But I found out very, very quickly that there were other guys around already that played guitar a lot better than I did at that point. Mm-hmm. I was still learning. And by default, I became a singer. Not because I set out to be a singer, but because the first ever gig that I did was with Pete and a couple of other blokes. And I was the lead guitar player.
Okay. All right.
There's a joke for you. Okay.
Yeah, he's just learning. Put him on lead.
Well, the reason I was the lead player was because the other guitar player knew a lot of chords and I didn't. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we arrived at this. It was a backyard party in a suburb of Brisbane called Inala. And we were nervous, of course. The guy who was supposed to be the singer, we set up our equipment you know, did a bit of tuning and got ready to do his thing, turned around, and he'd run away. He got stage fright, okay? Couldn't face it.
Right.
So we had a choice, you know. We could either leave with our tails between our legs, the ultimate embarrassment, or we could try and make a fist of it. And I was the only one stupid enough to put my hands up and say, well, I can remember some of the words. So I became a singer at that point and trying to play guitar at the same time. It's like slapping your head and rubbing your belly, you know. But nonetheless.
Trial by fire.
Soon after that, we actually did a talent quest, quite a big talent quest in Brisbane. Which we failed to win, of course. But we got on stage for our little spot, and I was trying to be lead guitar player and singer. And nonetheless, we had to get a rhythm guitar player who should have been holding everything together, okay? Mm-hmm. He took one look at the crowd, crapped himself, and spent the whole of our time on the stage with his on one knee with his back to the audience fiddling with the amplifier. So I was in a position suddenly of having to be the singer, the rhythm guitar player, and the lead guitar player. Now, believe me, I wasn't equipped for that. But we got through it, and about 2 days later, this guy, who was in the army at the time, arrived at where I was working, and he came in and he said, I saw you guys at the Summer Quest, and you guys need a good somebody who can play guitar. And I was a bit taken aback by this. I was like, smart ass. I'll show you. I said, okay, mate, if you reckon you can do it, we're going to have a rehearsal on such and such a day. Come on down. He turned up. Oh my God, he could play Cream. He could play Hendrix. You know, and all this stuff was going on. I thought, whoa, whoa, whoa. So I thought, well, that's it. Put the guitar in the case. I'm the singer. and that's the start of my singing career, really. But since then, you know, I learned the rudiments of guitar quite early. Mm-hmm. And I've always used it throughout my career as a way to write songs.
Right.
But until I came back from England in 1984, I hadn't done a gig playing a guitar. Mm-hmm. But when I got back here, I thought, you know what? I am now going to turn myself into a proper guitar, guitar player. And I have. I mean, I don't think of myself as a guitar player, but I do play the guitar. Mm-hmm.
Your voice is one of the most recognizable in Australian rock, clearly. How did you take care of your voice back in the day? I mean, you're literally spending an hour near screaming. Did you do any special preparation? You know,
Yes. I've got a special regimen that I always follow.
Yeah.
That's two Scotch and Cokes and a half a dozen cigarettes.
Gets the gravel in there.
No, I can't
imagine screaming that loud for that long.
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things, Nate. If you spend all of your time screaming, then your voice is going to have a short lifespan. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's all about dynamics. Okay. There may be situations where screaming is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So scream. But to spend all of your time at the very top end of your range screaming and squealing, that's a recipe for disaster.
Right.
All right. And I've always tried to pace what I do. In a lot of ways, I think it's luck more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, any athlete will tell you that the more that they're doing their sport, training and actually participating, mm-hmm. then the longer and faster and better they become.
Right.
Okay. And it's the same with being a singer. You know, in the early days of Buffalo, and in fact, through most of our career, we hardly ever had a week where we weren't doing seven gigs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I remember going to Melbourne once and doing eight shows in 2 days.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the way we used to work. Right. We were quite often be doing a school concert at lunchtime somewhere around the Sydney suburbs, doing a community hall or town hall show early in the evening and ending up with two spots between midnight and 3 o'clock at Checkers. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, almost invariably we'd be doing two or three gigs a night on a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you become match fit, you know. You don't need to be training when you're doing that because you're doing it all the time.
Right.
And my career was like that for the first 35, 40 years, I suppose, that I was doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, when I went to England, joined the Count Bishops, pretty much the same there. Mm-hmm. You know, if we weren't rehearsing, we were out gigging or in the studio. Right. Sing, 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 sing. You know, you become match fit. Right. Simple. But as I say, it's about pacing. It's like anything. Music is about pacing as well, generally. It's about dynamics, you know. If you play everything as loud as you possibly can all the time, it becomes just as banal as being quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have ups and downs.
Right.
You know, it needs to have some flow to it, not just a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's what it's all about, right. You know.
Yeah, it would seem to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but especially in those early days of Buffalo, there was a lot more going on off the stage as well that could potentially run hazard to your voice. You know?
Well, that's a very diplomatic way of saying it, I suppose. Yeah, well, you know, as I say, when I saw the Stones and when I saw what was going on, what really made me wanted to get involved with was the chance to sort of not be embarrassed by trying to pick up girls because they would be coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, I mean, I've got to be truthful with you, especially during Buffalo, those 6 to 7 years when we were on the road, every night was a party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a nonstop party, the longest party I ever went to, and it just didn't stop. I mean, I paid rent in a house in Sydney, and I'd be lucky to spend 4 or 5 weeks a year
mm-hmm.
actually in that house. The rest of the time I was in a Ford Transit van or somebody's car or in a motel somewhere in the far-flung reaches of mm-hmm. Australia. Yeah, you know, it's – I like to be constantly doing it.
Yeah.
I don't do it anywhere near as much now. I'm a bit of an elder statesman, you know.
Yeah.
and I figure I can be a bit more, you know, I don't really, we spoke earlier about my lack of interest in celebrity and all that sort of rubbish, you know. But as long as I can keep playing, that's all that really counts to me. How I became to be what I am, I really don't know, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me to have been a, sort of series of lucky incidents.
Yeah.
You know, starting out messing around with mates on the hostel. Next thing I knew, I'd been asked to join a band that was actually out there doing gigs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just went from that. I didn't set out to go to England and join the Count Bishops. The offer landed in my lap.
Yeah.
You know, I've always been ready to take the leap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, That trip could have been a complete disaster.
Mm-hmm.
It came close a couple of times and ended up very unfortunate situation. But you know, you take the chances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's the thread that ties it all together. You were brave enough, or at times maybe foolish enough, to say yes.
Foolish enough.
I'll sing. Okay. It could be looked at both ways because, you know, yeah, I'll sing or I'll do this. Yeah, I'll try the lead guitar. Yeah, yeah. I'll go to England and front this band. So let's just quickly touch on some of the recordings. You brought up Volcanic Rock.
Yeah.
Volcanic Rock, I think, again, a lot of people look at that as the high point, right?
Yes.
What was different about the recording of Volcanic Rock as opposed to Dead Forever?
Well, a couple of things, I think. The first album, as you would probably recall, we had two singers.
Okay.
I was the other singer. Alan Milano was the other singer. And really, we weren't completely settled on what our direction was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
We were being influenced by that whole hippie psychedelic sort of generation that was going on overseas
mm-hmm.
To a certain degree. And, you know, the reason Alan Milano ended up leaving the band and leaving me the sole singer was because he wanted to do something different. He didn't want to do what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of a bit betwixt and between on Dead Forever. By the time it came, the other thing was that, you know, Buffalo, from the word go, we never tried to learn other people's songs. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any of our own. So we used to go on stage and jam.
Right.
That was our gig. And we would make the songs up on stage. John would, after you'd done a couple of things, of course, you'd have specific riffs and ideas that we knew we were going to build on. Mm-hmm. And I would make the words up, and Alan would make up some words as well, right, on stage. And sometimes the songs would go for 5 or 10 minutes, okay? Mm-hmm. But it was appropriate for that time. You know, everybody was, you know, zonking out on Buddy Acid or whatever it was, you know. Mm-hmm. We were more interested in getting stoned and meeting mm-hmm. lots of girls. But but nonetheless, you know, so... But when we got to time to record Volcanic Rock, we had a pretty fair idea of what we were actually trying to do, and that was to be the loudest, most obnoxious bunch of assholes wandering around Australia, okay, making as much noise as we could. But nonetheless, you know, when we actually went in to record that album, we still only had the bare bones ideas of what songs we might do. We had nothing particularly sorted out, and most of that album was done as close to live as you could do things in those days. We'd go into the room, we'd have a basic idea. I'd have maybe a few lyrics just, you know, that I'd made up over the last couple of gigs. John would kick something off. Pete would come crashing in. Mm-hmm. I'd do some sort of warbling random words as a guide vocal, and then once we got that down, I'd disappear into the toilet or the nearest, you know, place I could isolate myself, and I'd just write the lyrics. You know, so it was
quite
like
spontaneous,
that.
Spontaneous, it sounds
like. Yeah, it's very spontaneous, you know, and most of Only Watch of Your Body was pretty much like that as well.
Okay,
you know, in some ways, you know, that mitigated against us ever coming up with a pop single, you know, which, as I say, we weren't interested in that anyway. You know, yeah. We were quite proud of the fact that radio stations wouldn't play us.
Did the record sell well at the
time? Oh, yeah. I've got gold record hanging on the wall, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I owed a couple as well, but it's in the past now.
Because I know at the time you had difficulty with radio play, and so it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, but once you saw that, okay, the controversy is not getting you any radio play, you almost embraced it. And yes. I'm looking at, like, the cover of Volcanic Rock,
yeah,
which was something that... I'm going to give people a moment to Google it right now.
Yeah. Because, you know, I've spoken about this to other people before, you know. And they say, oh, you know, those record covers, man, you know. Volcanic Rock, you know, blah, 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 and only went to, oh, that woman on the rack, you know. And, you know, it all seemed pretty simple to us at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the way people used to buy albums was they'd go to a record shop and they'd spend an hour or two leafing through the racks, looking at the covers.
Right.
Okay. You know, and if they saw something that they go, what's that? They would pick it up and have a look at it. Once they've done that, the chances are they're going to have a listen, mm-hmm. okay? So the idea is to make sure that what you have sitting in the rack draws people's attention. If it just blends into the background, it may be a wonderful piece of art.
But you're not going to pick it up.
But there's no controversy to it. There's nothing to say, oh, what the hell is this? You know, oh, mom won't like this one, right? But we knew that, you know, instinctively. We wanted things that people would go, holy shit, you know, how did they get away with this? You know?
I've got to hear what this sounds like.
That's right.
It looks so outrageous. Yeah. What, did you guys have an artist? Did you commission an artist to do that in the poster, or how'd that work?
Well, the record company used to commission the arts, mm-hmm. the art people for that. They had an art department, and they would commission somebody to do these things. But what would happen was that we would usually be called in to look at a number of different ideas that would be presented, mm-hmm. And then we'd pick, or at least tell them our preference.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, well, the thing like Dead Forever, you know, you have to have something on there that's got a skull and a horrible-looking face on it, surely. You know, it's appropriate. And Volcanic Rock, well, I mean, it all hangs together quite nicely, you know, the title and the artwork. I only want your body with the you know, obese woman stretched on the rack. Well, there's nothing subtle about
this. So that was one of the ideas the record company came up with, or was that something that you guys said, you know what would be great for this? Because you knew that the album was going to be called I Only Want You for Your Body.
That's what we were going to call the album, okay. No matter what happened. You know, okay. The interest, you know, the thing about it was when Volcanic Rock came out, the managing director or the MD of the record company here in Australia, was a guy called Ross Barlow, who was quite a straight-laced gentleman, nice bloke, but straight-laced. Mm-hmm. And he was appalled when that came out, that Volcanic Rock album. And just prior to the release of I Only Want You For Your Body, he had to go to America for some sort of corporate function or meetings and discussions and that. And he left strict instructions with his art department. I don't want to see anything approaching that sort of album cover again, all right? But while he was away, we snuck it through.
He came back shocked. Oh, my God. I can't leave you guys alone for a minute.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the last album, of course, was Average Rock and Roller. And, you know, I wasn't – by the time that album was released, I was already in England.
Right.
Because I, you know, the recording process and the whole thing, I thought, man – I don't want to do this anymore. This is crap, you know. And I didn't even see the album artwork or anything like that until some time after I'd been in England.
Right.
And when I saw it, I was appalled, quite frankly, because it looked like a really tacky K-Tel product, you know.
It's the woman on the motorcycle.
Yeah. I mean, what lame brain thought that up, you know? I mean, if you're going to do something like that, then what you do is you call your local, you know, Comancheros or Hell's Angels, and you get them down with a couple of their women with hardly any clothes on. You know what I mean? Come on.
See, you should have been in marketing. That's the...
Well, we were in marketing. You know, it is marketing, Nate. You know, at the end of the day, I mean, everything we do is marketing, really. Get on the stage, we're selling ourselves, right. You know. That's the idea. It all seems pretty straightforward to me, really, you know.
All righty, we're going to have to stop it right here. That's the end of part one. Episode 319 with part two will be up shortly. Now, you could always hear it right friggin' now going to patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support our show and get the extras. Otherwise, please subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast on your podcast app and get alerted immediately when part two is available. Until then, we'll see you on the flip-flop. Cheers.